For those that don't know it, I'm Joe Chadwick, and I'm the assistant to the bishop in Eastern Michigan Synod in the area of social justice and advocacy. And my partner is my brother from my San Francisco, Oakland family.
Oakland
family, where I have been, where I am still a member since my pastor has not released my name yet, Will Hertzfeld, who was to have been here. And I was going to spend 2 weeks convincing him that I could have my membership transferred to him. And we're going to share the session. But I'd like to read you a poem first, and then we would sort of like to check out your expectations and go from there. This is a session on building the rainbow, starting with language. And I think that's if we cannot begin other places. Last week I heard a lot of, well, we don't have black people in our community, we don't have Native Americans in our community, everybody looks just like us. This is a how to do it without the folks there session. So that I'm sorry you will not be able to get off with that excuse any longer. This is a poem written by Donna Schaefer, and it's called, God, I Cannot Call You Father. God, I cannot call you father. Sometimes I cannot even call you mother. And yet I know that you continue to call me daughter. Words don't mean anything they say. Learn to speak half a language. Learn to call God half a name. But you, O God, rage with me. My ears matter, words matter to me, and they matter to you as well. You are gentle in the face of the insult, in the face of half a name, but I am not. Father God, Mother God, teach us how to speak. Forgive the idolatry, show us the way to your name. You throw in your lot with us, you share with us the power to name. You choose sometimes to break out of your parent, to be brother or wind, fire or spirit, to be hidden, to be other than who we think you are. She dwells among us. He walks the road we walk. She carries our burdens. He liberates us. And yet we don't even know her. We mistake him for one half of us. She did send a man, the man Jesus, the concrete human who must have gender, the form of God, when he chose to be more than parent. But she stayed above our captivity and his captivity to concreteness. She kept a bit of mystery. He kept the wind at her disposal. She saved the fire for his presence. Beyond mother and beyond father, beyond even parent, O God, you live, willing to let us address you, willing to let us call your name, and smiling beyond your rage. Hear us when we call. Respond even when we name you with your own name. And name us, O God. Call me daughter. Call me sister. Call me a woman whom the Spirit has known. Give me the concreteness you gave your son. Honor my partialness and reveal again and again your mystery. That becomes a different experience for me as a woman, to be able to name and to call God woman, and to the feminine, those experiences, those religious experiences. I need to say right out front that I'm not one who advocates a genderless thought. I know some people do, and so I guess for me it's important that God is all-encompassing and has gender. In addition, today we want to talk also about those cultural experiences. This is the female side of it, but there's also those experiences and those things within our worship and within our religious life that need to be called upon in terms of cultural experience, maybe American brothers and sisters who for whom Earth is such a powerful symbol, heaven, the stars. Our Black brothers and sisters, our Asian brothers and sisters, they have a different experience. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
One thing that I've been here the 2 weeks of Rainbow, and one thing that struck me is, among many, is the first week there were, well, number one, I guess there were just plain were more Blacks, but also in the unique person of Rudy Featherstone, a Black theology professor from Columbus, Ohio. He fairly uniquely, with an extraordinary personal integrity, I think, was as bicultural a communicator as I've ever known. And in many ways, he wonderfully and genuinely was in what might be called Black preacher mode, where there's often a call and response kind of thing with the congregation and a willingness to speak as, quote, the Spirit moves one, and all that's involved in that. And during the first week at worship and at other events, it was not at all uncommon for, Rudy and some of the other Black participants, but also some of the other people here, to respond, as the Spirit moved them in worship and whatever. And this week, I felt almost a little silly in that I'm real comfortable in responding that way, partially because I'm in a multicultural congregation where some people do, although Bethlehem in those particular
Bethlehem
terms
is quite
straight. But nonetheless, if you do something there, no one turns around and says, "Was that weird, dude?" or whatever. And but it struck me that you can probably go in most white churches, and if you come up with a loud amen or preach brother or right on or whatever, you'll be looked at as, wow, strange, weird, what's going on
here.
That's
a three person, really.
My association with Bethlehem is really quite recent. My wife and I were for 17 years involved in a essentially ill white congregation called First Lutheran Church in Oakland, and now affectionately known as Black Lutheran. And I remember vividly one time a kind of three-person showed there, and I happened to have been preaching that particular Sunday, and he was responding to me, I like the fact that even in that sterile place, he could, for whatever reason, sort of feel comfortable doing that, but the rest of the place. And white people culturally are pretty strange about expressing themselves. At a football game, or some other sports event, or a rock concert, they're relatively free. But to think that the only level of communication between human beings is one in which Herr Pastor proclaims or performs in front and everyone else sits still and looks bored is terribly limiting in the range of communication that human beings are possible. And there's nothing that makes human beings more unique than the fact that they can communicate with the absolute infinite range of communication.
Bob, can I answer something?
Sure.
What's funny, in our church in Detroit, we're like a real middle class. To get an amen in our church has been very difficult.
That's right. I sit in the church and I
in order to even get our choir to clap, the choir has resisted it. And we've got a black director now. And I mean, he really, you know, is a black background, that movement, traditional. And so now he's trying to get us into clapping and patting our foot. But we're truly not used to saying amen, and to get an amen in our church is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like the whites, but it's people with traditional Lutheran background.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, I was raised Lutheran all my life, and I don't know how to sing the real get on gospels and how to ad-lib that in music,
yeah.
Because I don't have that.
I'm sure at Bethlehem there are a fair number of black members who are uncomfortable, and I've heard them say that, well, if we wanted that sort of thing, we'd
go
to a Baptist church or
exactly
Pentecostal or Holiness, whatever. And yet, part of the genius of Bethlehem is the range of communication, the range of music, and the range of openness. And
I don't want to get into the specials of Bethlehem.
Oh, sure.
It's real easy for us to do that. And, you know, just I wanted to get into where Auburn, and if it's applicable, he'll illustrate. I guess what I would like to know from here is language problems for the folks in this room. Would you like help in terms of that, or is that something that you feel comfortable with in terms of changing language? Some people have problems, you know, even looking at that, to change the language that God must have given us, written on the tablets for Moses.
Okay, that sort of took me aback from my heart at the moment. I was going to kind of piggyback on what Bob said.
Okay.
Could you do a short piggyback? I'm curious.
I'll show you that later.
Okay.
I think in terms of the language of expectations within ethnic groups, and particularly black in this case, when we talk about the amens, I wouldn't say that is the norm in black churches. I grew up Methodist, and while there is a diverse appreciation of music, we didn't have a lot of spirituals and a lot of gospel. We had one Sunday devoted to that. All other Sundays was the tradition of Methodist service. And I think outside of some Baptists and some Pentecostals and some other denominations for blacks, where the amens are acceptable, and I've visited many of them, but I guess I don't like to be looked upon as, because I'm black, that I fit into all of these stereotypes. And I think when we talk about language, that's something that I think we can share, that is a different kind of language that we speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that was a little bit different from what you
came
up with the tableau.
I think one thing I find is I hear a lot of lay people, and even in my congregation, which is interracial congregation, is the volume of black preachers. I think they're so used to the even tone, one page turn after another page turn type of preaching. when they get a preacher that talks more than 10 or 15 minutes, they're squirming in their seats already. And when they get one that raises his tone, and yells or hollers or speaks up, they don't know how to react to it.
Mm-hmm.
We recently had a pastor, we just called a new pastor, and so we had people coming in preaching for the last year, and one of the preachers that came in to preach was a black preacher. How many denominations was he?
A lot.
He was a Seventh-day Adventist pastor at one time. He was
a
whole lot of different kinds. Now he's Lutheran.
That's a political thing. I don't get that politics. You're
nevertheless,
right. Nevertheless.
The people, the blacks liked it. They truly did enjoy his sermons. His sermons were uplifting. People went home talking about, I really got a good message. And then downstairs I heard the whites grumbling about, how loud it was. One lady said, I'm not coming back because he scared me because he hollered so loud. But I'm being very honest. And I heard the same thing when Rudy Featherstone spoke. I heard people criticizing the volume of it, of the length of it. I heard people saying the gospel choir sang too loud. Four people was in the gospel choir, and I heard people talking about how loud that they were singing. It was too loud. But it's just because we're not used to it, and we're not giving it a chance to accept the there's a variety of preaching.
Yeah, it's the acceptance of the variety. It's not, as we said here, it's not that everyone fits into those stereotypically, but how can we acknowledge some of the cultural diversity that we hope our church has and integrate that into the life of the church?
There's a real interesting thing about the development of language. Virtually every language develops as an oral language. And then somewhere along the way, someone figured out how to come up with symbols to make this into written words. And what's happened in the West is the orality of the the first great poetry, the Odyssey and the Iliad in the Western world, were orally transmitted. People memorized them. They were not written down for centuries. And in Finland, and all over Africa, in many parts of the world, you find oral poets who come up with long, long epics. And then things get written down, and what often happens after that is, instead of an oral tradition, we have a written tradition and a reading tradition. And that's real, real different in the range of and communication going on. I'd like to shift gears a slight bit by talking about a quotation I ran across the other day. It was by the poet W.H. Auden. And he said, I see my primary political responsibility as a poet to fight the corruption of the language. And he was had enormous corruptive power of the whole thing about double talk and newspeak and euphemisms and all of that. And I think we're in a funny time in terms of the corruption of language. A lot of people have gotten far politically with enormous deception, dishonesty in the way they use the language. They're using it to get their own political agenda, and in the process they're really messing around with it. In a way, there are the English language probably is more in flux today than it has been since the time of Shakespeare. In the time of Shakespeare and the King James Bible, English was all over the place, and those two wonderful bodies of literature helped a lot to kind of stabilize it and move it on. The way it's going wild right now has partially to do with media. And often the influence of media is to homogenize the language. Every national anchor person speaks essentially the same bland kind of English, both in terms of its accent and in terms of its
television English,
of its grammar and structure and that sort of thing. But at the same time, other folk are noticing how language has been used to demean and on all the stuff that feminists and blacks and others are saying about it. And
here comes over the top of the balcony.
Boy, what a power position.
How high is the pulpit in your church?
And if I may say one more thing, you're real welcome to respond. May I say one more thing?
Yeah.
Okay. What? And in that process, I think a lot of really healthy stuff has been said. But my concern is that people in the same time be concerned about making the language powerful, honest, and capable of enormous human interaction that it can be if we don't allow it to be corrupt. And I'd be the last person to try and say what that all means real practically. But I think it's extraordinarily important that we be sensitive to those dimensions.
Yes. I was going to say that it seems to me that one of the first things that happened when feminists began to talk about inclusive language is that people that were in positions of power in terms of education and media said that we were corrupting the language. And that was one of the things. So one of the first things that I began to do is to try to make a distinguish between corruption of the language, i.e. gobbledygook, and the fact that languages do change, and that English is losing its grammatical gender. So I mean, so that whole business about how to talk about the use of language in a creative and good way, as opposed to the kinds of things that we're forced into with slang or actually business kinds of political kinds of moves.
The National Association of Teachers of English has all kinds of literature out, as well as many publishers, about the inclusification of the language.
But it took them a while.
It took them a while, yeah. But there's a lot of really solid, strong reasoning and information available through that organization. It's important to put this on a bit of a theological context. My mother points out regularly whenever she visits a church and they're not inclusive in their language, the power of the word, to the point that in the beginning was the word, and that we named that, you know, and God spoke, and it was so. And we name that in our theological tradition, and it's important to remember that Juliet's speech about that which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. It might smell as sweet when named in another way, but we might not be drawn towards its smell if it were called something else. Something with which I struggle at this point is the images of darkness and lightness in our liturgies and in our scriptures. I have been particularly sensitized to that over the last year, as so often we find darkness being equated with bad. You know, there's a light that shines in the darkness, so a light that the darkness has not been able to put out. And I struggle with that in terms of changing it. I try to leave day and night images as day and night, mm-hmm. and talk about the shadow or something else rather than darkness as a way of and it's a struggle for me, and I need some help in dealing with that, and I was hoping that would be a part of our conversation today.
I think we've been through one of these exercises earlier this week about, you know, what images we have when we say black, white, yellow, red. Mm-hmm. And the black images were, you know, all negative. Mm-hmm. And the white, you know, the white was all positive, and or not all, most positive. And so this is the next step of that. Mm-hmm. We is the dark and light then being the negative and the. And this is tough.
And how are we communicating that to each other, wherever we are?
And what are some of the options to put in those places?
Seems to be mainly gray.
Yeah, but that isn't. You know, this is why we have them here. Cause I can't do that.
And that bothers me. That gray is somehow corrupted white. Yes. White being clear, yes, and understandable,
it's
as opposed to black.
It's indecisive. White. Well, we don't know what gray is.
Yeah.
Does someone have some ideas around that? That is a struggle when you get past.
I liked your attempt at keeping seasons separating out seasons from the symbolics, you know, and the social, behavioral kinds of, it's making those separations. I think that's helpful. As you mentioned that, I struggle with that. It's good, and it's helpful to get at that distinction. That means we need to take the time to do that. You know, how many times, if you take a look at the typical church worship service on the sermons and that sort of thing, do we not watch our watches? Mm-hmm. Language also is a process of sharing together. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty of the one-hour worship service, which we as Euro-Americans expect, or even less now we're down to 50-minute hour.
That's even better, right?
Yeah. And the media, the way we do it is mm-hmm. really crucial. Get adult forums on language and all that sort of thing, just to get people to come down and sit together is one of the great challenges of gathering us to be together long enough to perceive our diversities in that way. I like your distinguishing between season and psychology, behavioral, social kinds of behavior, and symbolic mm-hmm. Messages of light and dark. Which is, that's a struggle. We got to help people.
We have to help each other with that.
One of the things I noticed in terms of language that was confusing to me, and I know that the whole thing of white and black referring to races is something that came out, I think I noticed it first in the 60s because the old names were sort of even more confusing. And, but I find white and black and yellow confusing too. And because I haven't seen a black or a white person in a long time, I did see it.
That's right. That's right.
No, I mean, really, we're talking
about... If you saw a black person, it would scare you, because there's cameras.
Yeah, I know.
And, I've never seen a white person.
We were camping a couple of days, a couple of weeks ago up in Canada, and there was this young teenage boy. He's about as close to white as I've ever seen. And I would call him an albino.
Right, mm-hmm. Weird.
But that's very unusual. I mean, none of us are even remotely white or black. We're all kind of different
shades. Yeah, red
and
yellow.
And I know it's sort of a, I guess it's got its own consensus, this use of the word
it's
white and black.
It's worked itself into our language.
Because it's sort of got a liberal tinge to it, but I see it as a sort of a, not a very helpful thing, and I don't know what we could put in its place.
Yeah, I was going to ask for that.
You know, because then we get into mauve and...
Last night in the worship service, my six-year-old daughter turned to me and said, "Red?" Mother Will's a red person. I was tempted to say sunburned, you know.
Yeah, well, I've seen that.
But even that's pink.
From on high, the words are.
I get the feeling about it. I'm always interested in seeing the reaction of the ethnic communities whenever that song about black and white, red and
they leave out brown.
Precious things.
Because it seems to me,
Jesus was the most.
Yeah, it seems to me we go through phases of that. I can remember the confusion that the white community had back in the pre-60s. We called the black community Negro. Then we went to black. Then we went to
Afro-American
color. And it seems to me that that's exactly where I think that the white community and I need to listen to our brothers and sisters of the particular ethnic community that is trying to sensitize us to how we tromp all over, you know. So if they don't want to be called yellow, then we ought to pay attention to that. If the blacks want to be called black at the moment, we ought to pay attention to that and go with them. And
I like people.
Yeah.
Joanne over here, and then Billy, and then
Well,
Joanne first.
Okay. I found many things helpful, and this is getting down to the grassroots.
Yes.
And some of you know why this is so helpful to me. I think we are all thinking about the future or the next generation, right? And so we're all affecting some children around us, hopefully, one way or another. And I have, four very special little ones, but two especially, who so far we have still just a great relationship, and they're looking to me for some
answers to questions. So far, they haven't been too hard yet, but I hope that the response.
So you need to do, not everyone knows. What should I say?
I don't know. I'm happy. We have been very blessed to be in a biracial family because our daughter and a black man have fallen in love, married, and we have two black grandchildren now. Okay, now what I just really want to get to the basics is
and
to
they
say
are other. Your grandchildren.
I also have two white cousins now, and they just are wonderful together. But when, I don't know when it's going to come up, but when my other grandchildren look in the mirror and say, and somebody says, okay, they're black father, white mother, and somebody says, well, you're half black and you're half white, and they look in the mirror and say, I'm not half black. And this for me, I'm already correcting somebody, nobody said it yet, it may be my other two grandchildren, I want to use the right, what's going to be effective for them in the world, and I know Helen and I haven't had enough time together, and she's leaving, and I feel really deprived, but for Jennifer and Austin, so what I'm saying to myself right now that I want to respond, they are biracial. Is that okay, when Jennifer or the other two say, okay, they aren't half black, white, you said that we should respond.
And that was cynical.
Yeah, I'm being really honest because I want to be helpful. What are they, Helen?
See, the thing that everybody seems to forget, no matter what nationality we are or where we come from, we are all people of color. It doesn't matter that I'm not the same color she is.
I'm black Irish.
I'm not the same color she is. I'm not the same color you are, but we are all people of color. And it's God's decision that made me the color I am, her the color she is. And that is actually what makes the world so beautiful. And if we can get away from the nationalities and the countries and the power struggles and all of this, then maybe that will almost be our common ground.
Well, she says that, wait a minute. Okay, when her other grandma, they had their hands together on a table, and she just looked down and said, oh, your hand is the same color as my daddy's. Now that's as far as we've gotten, but you see, I want to be able to respond. I can't respond to her like you just said, because it's too grown up, right? But, and I may never have to. I still, okay, one other thing, and then I'll get off. Who decides what we call a race? Who decides that I'm called the white race? Who decides the blacks want to be called black?
I'm so naive. No, they always say that people name themselves. So that's how we got here.
I have to
get the woman on the balcony. I'm sorry. It's okay? Different direction.
I'm not saying anything to offend any of
them. No, don't worry about offending. This group's a great group. Does anybody have some answers for Joanne?
My generation.
Go ahead.
We chose to be black. My mother's generation had a hard time with it because she was Negro.
Yeah. My mother still says colored people.
Wait a minute. we're talking about revolving kinds of labels, okay? And we chose, I'm a product of the 60s and the sit-ins and the spit-ins and whatever else. And we chose because that was an identity for us. We did not want to identify with all of the crap that the Negro label brought, okay? And I would say to you, why do you need a label for your grandchildren anyway?
Yeah.
You know, they are unique and they are precious, and they have been given the gift of having a black father and a white mother, and that's beauty, and that's what they should be taught, to respect each of their parents, okay?
And each of their grandparents. And
I would say the most important thing for your children, your grandkids, is their self-esteem, and you keep building that person rather than that color. And that's the best thing that can happen.
Very helpful. Diana and Janet.
I haven't taught it yet, but I teach a program called Philosophy for Children, and it's based in community and dialogue and discussions, and we always had to read a philosophical source last year at school and then relate it to a chapter in the novel that is written for children. And I read this source, it was a 4-page paper, and I took 13 weeks to write a 3-page paper. And it was by Michael Sloat, and it's called Most Important Criteria. And he used animals, and how much, and we teach children that a whale is a mammal. And we teach children that everything fits in a very specific category from very early on, because it's simple. And it's really the hardest thing to undo as we get older. The Chinese called the whale a fish. That's the way it was. And then we made a list of criteria of all their characteristics. And the scientists decided that the most important criteria for mammals was that they nurse their young and they breed. So using that criteria, a whale is a mammal. Now, it looks like a fish. you ask a kid, what is this? That's a whale. It looks like a fish, you know. It's sort of the same thing. You know, in my program, we try to teach kids, there's so many gray areas, it sounds like a ladder, you know. There may be a true fish, there may be a true black, there may be a true white, there may be... But then it's always continuing all the way up and down. And to get kids to learn that when they're 6 and 7, and 8, and 13, 15, then maybe they know it when they're 25, 60. But the most important criteria in this article, the thing that cracked me up the most, was that why we call the things what they are, to answer your question, is because the experts in that field get to choose what the most important criteria is.
The experts in what field?
In whatever field you're talking about.
In racism?
That would always be up, you know, like the scientists get, the biologists or the marine biologists get to choose what the most important criteria is for whales or whatever. But, you know, it seems like...
Do you buy that?
Psychologists.
Do I buy that?
Yeah.
Do I buy it? I don't know. But I don't know. It made me... It seemed really ironic.
The last person I'd want to name anything are sociologists.
They
should get a 25% disability for speech impediments.
But it's all language. It's all language. And it's all how we talk about language. It's all our attitude towards language. And it's whether we use the... You know, if we go with what, if a whale's a fish and we talk about whales being fishes, you know, we can look at that attitude, or if we want to look at the experts when we read our journals and they say it's a mammal, it's fine. But, you know, it's all language. It's all our attitude and how important we're going to think.
I've got to get Janet because she's wiping. Unless she wants to respond.
No, go ahead.
I think it's important to raise the kids to know that they are the best of both races. That they are a byproduct of well, they are what their mothers and dads made them, and they are the best of the white and the best of the black. But then on the other hand, we're going to have to realize that they were still in society that's going to label them, and they're going to be labeled black. And I have a lot of friends that have interracial marriages, or even friends that had white girlfriends that chose to get pregnant and had black kids, and they're trying, and they raised their kids to know that they are black. But I'm, when they fill out forms, a lot of my friends, they do check other.
Oh, is that?
That's what she meant by other.
No, they ask you black, white, Asian, or other, and they do check.
Check the one that gives them the most money for the scholarship to go to school. I mean, you.
It's only 2%.
What I'm trying to say is, society puts labels on everyone, and we raise our kids to be proud of themselves and what they are, and of their parents. But society is still going to put a label on them. And our society says if you've got one drop of life blood in you, you are blood.
Okay, actually blood is red.
Now the balcony.
That's right.
But can I say one more thing?
Marie speak, because she's raising kids. I raise your kids, and she might want to have something to add to it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
I kind of came in a little bit, but my children went to a school. Well, one is still going to that school, but my oldest one is 14. I don't know how many of you know him. He's around. He doesn't look, you know, white or black, but in a predominantly kind of a half and half. Half black, half white school. I didn't raise them one way or the other. I never really talked about it except to say, you know, you have to have a really neat dad and you have really neat grandparents on both sides, and we talk about that. But I have a cousin who's also raising a biracial child, and she started out very emphatically from the very beginning to teach him that he was black. But I noticed that my son, moving now to a high school that is almost all white, has been really questioning his value, and he doesn't talk about it, but he talks about straightening his hair, and he talks about using sunscreen so he's not going to get any tanner. And it's really sad to me because I think he's gorgeous.
Well, he is.
But in his eyes, he maybe doesn't think that the girls will like him as much because
that's 14.
Somewhat black. And that's in his mind. So it's something that he's got to struggle with also.
Responding to your discussion on the experts and who decide, I struggle with that as a journalist, how language is going to be used. And I resist turning to the Associated Press handbook and having that always be the Bible in terms of what our rules are going to be. Nonetheless, we have to strive for consistency, and so we try to say that this will be our rule. And a few times, twice in my 7-year career of working in the communications office of the ALC, we bucked the AP handbook because someone had come to us and said, I don't care what the accepted style is in the language today, it is no longer acceptable or it is wrong. And what that taught me is that we have the power to say, no, we're not going to do it that way anymore. Now we're going to start referring to something different. One was a very articulate black woman that worked on our staff came to me and said, I'm fed up with press releases that refer to Asian people and other people of color groups with capital first letters and black people with a lowercase small b. Well, we didn't know what to do with that because we always use small b and small w for black and white, but Asian, because it's a proper name, refers to Asia, officially gets they get a capital letter, but sorry, you people don't get a capital letter. You know, white people don't get a capital letter either. So, you know, it's so silly that this should be an argument because we're professionals trying to do our job the right way and we want our work to be respected by the other professionals and so forth. Well, you know, finally she just raised such an articulate argument. She said, I don't care if you think I'm a proper noun or I'm not a noun. I'm a person and my name deserves a capital letter and that's all. And so we just said, okay. That's what we're going to do from now on. So for the last 2 years of the life of the ALC anyway, we referred to black people with a capital B. And the other change we made in our style, which I find very comfortable for me, is not to refer to groups as, I try never to refer to groups as reds, yellows, etc., but to refer to white people, black people, Asian people, and always follow that name or descriptor or however one you want to use it with the word people or person. That was very helpful to me.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you, Carol.
Just as maybe as a constructive thing, since language, like any kind of technological tool, is used for in a sort of a, it has a sort of a neutral quality about it. We're trying to do something. It certainly has a very important use, and to get through life and not, you know, to make things as clear as we can. But it's obvious that black and white and oriental or red and yellow, we're coming to the end of this, the usefulness of these terms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the evolution now is coming to another step. And I think, it's too easy to, for bean counters and people that are in, various kinds of technological experts and everything. They want to show, it's just done, in many cases, it's not done nastily, but it's done for utilitarian purposes, to shove this number of people in black and this mm-hmm. red and yellow. It might be the next step might be for us to go back into the old crayon box and find your color.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. And that would really blow everybody's mind, because they would know, when you say, find the color that you that describes you best, and then when somebody says, what are you? They say, well, I'm a burn umber, or beige or something. I'm a beige person.
Or
I think it'd be wonderful. The village sent down and got one of the deluxe pack
Creole.
When I do this next time, that's what we're going to do.
Some computers have about 3,000 choices.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
But I even have an activity with kids where they mix up paints. And I have them to look in the mirror, and I say, look in the mirror and find out what color you are, and take these paints and mix it in and paint your face. And they do it, and we talk about it, and they enjoy it. They love it. And then it gets them into talking about their differences and their similarities. And that's all we want to know about. That's all we need to know about each other. It's what we have in common, what we have in differences. I want to talk about the language bit again, because one thing that I'm concerned about is, and I'm glad you brought up about
the APA,
is how they describe people of color, and especially when they've done something wrong. Okay? There hardly ever is something good about a person of color, especially a black. And if there is, it's on the back page in just one, maybe two or three little sentences. But the descriptions of people of color is always negative. And they use certain words. I can almost tell without seeing the person what color they are. And my daughter was referred to as being fiery. Well, I wouldn't exactly say she's fiery. I would say that she's a very articulate, intelligent person, and a assertive person that expresses herself very well. And for someone to say she's fiery just irks the hell out of me. And those are the little issues of language that bothers me, is how we view people of color and the kinds of things we say about them and our way of trying to be nice and kind. And I think we need to be sensitive
and we're not
to that.
At all.
Yeah, it's not so at all.
Okay.
That would be precisely what I was going to say, and it relates both to Anne and the last comment. And it has to do with the kinds of forms that our police ask us to fill out. I don't know if you've ever filled out a police report, but I've had some gang problems in my church recently, and so I've called them any number of times, and I'm doing the reporting of criminal activity on my property, and they ask me such questions as, how old are you? What's your driver's license number? It's not a vehicle violation at all. And the last question was, in order to get out of asking me what my race was, the police asked me with a sort of phone, what is your descent? Do you realize the power that gave me? It was wonderful. So I said, I'm a child of God.
The alleged pastor
of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church.
Not the alleged child of God. Down here.
There's a whole communication, which when we talk about words, the most I don't know the statistics, I've heard so many different descriptions of the amounts, but of all communication, the nonverbal aspect of our communication.
Mm-hmm. We're not dealing with that today, yeah.
Is so much powerful, and how we say to our children, you know, we use the word, whatever the terms might be, verbally, but it's what really comes across, 78% of that nonverbal communication.
Which frees me up a lot, because I'm real good at that.
I mean,
you can count on 75% of that working for you.
Yeah.
Doing that comment.
I may be putting too much emphasis. I'm so afraid of what comes out of my mouth is going to affect their future, and I realize there's some social things that are totally out of my control. And maybe that frees me a lot. But I do want to take my responsibility very seriously, because one other real quick thing that Susan affirmed me on, that I'm going to say again, simply because I think Chuck and I are called to do this, and we didn't realize it. We feel we have been chosen as a family, and I want to be sure that if we're chosen to do this, that we take our responsibility very seriously, and we could have being chosen, we could have denied or accepted that. And obviously, we put it in the Lord's hands and we accepted it. And it's a whole new world for us that we're grateful for, but I sometimes get real worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be here for you.
Up here, then.
This is an earlier experience I want to relate, hopefully kind of quickly, about I was serving a black church in Chicago back in the 60s, and we went to Florida on a trip, and had car trouble and had to pull off in a tiny little town, and just a little bit of a parts department, and the guy said he couldn't do any work because he had bad heart, but he said, if you know how to handle a wrench, I'll have to put your fuel gauge in, or fuel pump in. He said, I make a hell of a boss man if you know how to use a wrench. And I said, I know how to use a wrench, but I don't know what to do. So we were working at it. And in drove a black man, and so he went off to serve this guy, and the guy was white who was selling me this thing. And he came back after serving this guy and said, you know, I moved down here from Tennessee. They told me to look out for the niggers. And I thought, oh boy, here I am, I gotta get my car fixed. And I need this guy's expertise. But I am not gonna wanna listen to this kind of conversation. And trying to figure out what I was going to do. And he says, you know, they told me, because niggers are going to steal, they're going to cheat, and they're going to rob you, and you're not going to be able to depend on them. And he said, you know, I met a lot of people like that. And he said, for sure we're right, we need to look out for them. He said, the only thing he didn't tell me, what color they were. I said, okay.
Thank you.
I can live with this guy. He says, I sure enough met a lot of those kind of people. Because they're not being all the same color.
That's right. That's great.
Another area I'm concerned about is the communication of the language and of our green hymnal. A lot of people think that our green Lutheran Book of Order of Services is the gospel, and that's the only language that we can use in the church. And I think that we have to realistically think about that there's other ways of doing it. And if we really want to reach people of other ethnic groups, then we have to use other diverse meanings other than the Lutheran Book of Service. And not only that, the songs. How many times do you leave church on a Sunday morning and you sing an anthem or out of the Lutheran Book of Service, and you don't know it by the time you get out the door? But when you sing a spiritual like we did last night, that filled me. I heard the bells this morning. I mean, I left the auditorium singing that. And so that maybe all churches don't have other books. You know, we have a supplemental hymnal. Maybe other churches don't have supplemental hymnals. But we have to have other kind of music, because we have to remember that book and those songs were written at that period of time. And the liturgy was written at that time. And that's not gospel. We don't have to use that. And that's the kind of language I'd like to see us talk about now.
We will send James Harris around the country to 6,000 congregations.
I think that green hymnal is historically going to be viewed as a transition.
Yeah.
A transition document, because it's pretty new stuff.
But we need
it's
a loose-leaf notebook type.
We've learned so
not
much
anymore.
That, you know, that I
things
think
that can't change.
The history
it's no spirituals in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, but it's just, it's better than what came before, but it's
and the language is better, but it's not where we want it to be.
It's not satisfactory all of these.
As usual, we are about to eat. Those of us who are leaving today know we have to be at that first session. I want to say thanks for always ending with lots more questions than answers, because that's the way life is. And thank you for your support. Thank you.